Welcome Daniel Victor to the Stumble Forward. Daniel is a Canadian Juno-nominated recording artist and producer from Windsor, Ontario, best known for his collaborative music project, Never Ending White Lights. Daniel's song, The Grace, featuring the voice of Dallas Green, was a number one hit in Canada and would be the song that would establish City in Colour as a stalwart on Canadian indie rock radio. I had dinner with Daniel a few weeks back when I was in Windsor, and it was such a fabulous chat that I wanted to bring him on and maybe have a chat even somewhere in the neighborhood, similarly mind-blowing as we had that time. Let's do it. Please welcome Daniel Victor. Hey, Daniel.
Hello. Hello.
Are you well?
I am well. Okay. I am doing the balancing act, the great balancing act between trying to, figure out what my challenges mean and how to navigate through my life without getting angry when things don't go the way I want them, and making progress on my return to music again.
Okay, because it's in, when I was looking at your wiki, which I guess we all have one now, there is a space that says, like, we're still waiting for the fourth installment. Let's go back to the beginning here in Windsor, Ontario. You grew up in Windsor, is that right?
Yeah, I was born and raised here.
Yeah, and you come, like, your dad was a figure in the entertainment scene there somehow or other. Is that right?
Yeah, he had a band in the 70s that was really popular in the area, drew a lot of people. And he started a record company and a recording studio in the 80s. So he did a lot of local bands. He did commercials. And he landed a show on CBC, which was like a variety show, a Sinatra type of thing. And so I kind of grew up from, you know, being around recording equipment and session players and him being an entertainer, and he taught me how to play guitar and drums. And so it was always kind of around in the family.
And was this like a local CBC television show? Is that what it was? What was the variety show called? Where would we have seen it?
Well, yeah, it was a local thing. It's probably Southern Ontario.
Yeah, right.
Thursday nights at 8 o'clock or something. I think it ran an hour, and it just featured different artists from the area. They would come and do a duet, Tom Jones, that sort of stuff. It was schmaltzy. He had a tuxedo and the frilly stuff. But I think it ran about 4 years on CBC, but he loved the experience of being on CBC. You know, he had writers and they wrote jokes for him, and he got to sing with a full orchestra, which was really cool.
So you'd say you grew up in a musical household. Like, was this a natural evolution for you to sort of take the baton from your dad and continue on in a musical capacity?
Well, I mean, you know, that's the thing. If he had been a hockey coach, I've been hockey. And I think we're all sort of born with an innate set of gifts, interests, passions that we naturally pursue. But he sort of helped harmonize everything that I was interested musically growing up anyway. So it was this sort of like perfect learning ground for me. Mm-hmm. To see recording process works, to understand engineering and musical composition. So as I studied music and as I played music in local bands and stuff, you know, my father in the studio business was kind of, it was just like a three-dimensional way of experiencing music.
Yeah. You went to University of Windsor. Was it for music? Was it for engineering? Was it for something else? What were you doing there?
I thought about it, but then I thought I didn't want to get hung up on the boring parts of music.
Yeah.
Like the parallel fifths and the string arrangements and all that stuff, because music theory always just, that was a nightmare for me. So I decided to take communications and worldviews like spirituality sort of based stuff. And I didn't really have a great time in university. I was just trying to get a degree out of the way so I could go and make my first record.
Right. And so why? Were your parents like, oh, Daniel, it's important that you have an education. Look at how difficult the entertainment business is, type of thing?
You know the story. Worry about, you know, it's hard to make it in music, get a real job. The thing was, my mother was, she's a very she praises academic
achievement, like
achievement as high on the echelon. So I wanted to make her happy that I had this diploma and that I was educated, whatever you want to call it. And we made a deal. And she said, you know, I won't give you such a hard time if you want to go make music, if you just complete a degree and start from there. And graduation day, I was like running to the studio. I think I got on a plane to LA like the next day to go work with Switchfoot. And we co-wrote a great song that ended up selling 3 million copies. And my mom was like, well, maybe you don't need the degree, you know, just follow what you love. And then the rest is kind of history.
Did you do any time in Toronto? Like, I get this feeling like, you know, there's some similarities between you and I in that there's a bit of a loner thing and a bit of a, I did my time in Toronto, left, and then almost never went back. You never did the Toronto thing. Like, did you dig into the Queen Street? Like, you existed from Windsor. Is that right?
No, I did. I was there.
Okay.
I had a little apartment on Bay Street for a while. And I spent every weekend there. And I wanted it to do more for me than it did. I love Toronto because, first of all, I mean, great nightlife, great food, great people, great energy. My label was there. My agent was there. Publicist was there. So there was like a family in Toronto. But I didn't attach to it. It just didn't feel organic enough. And I actually enjoyed coming back to, because the thing with Windsor is we have Detroit next door. So yeah. If you want to see vibe, and it's quite dark and gothic and gritty. And I grew up going to shows there, you know, punk shows and all that. So I have that city urban element close by. And Windsor, you know, we're close to a county too. And it's just like, it's sort of a nice hybrid between the city grit and sort of like a low key place to kind of chill.
When I saw you a few weeks back, one of the things that I had at the top of my mind to talk with you about was the whole City in Color thing, which is, you know, it's a strange situation that you wrote this guy's first hit song. And in some ways, like, you introduced his voice through your project to the Canadian, you know, music listening landscape. It's just a very odd situation that somebody would sort of go on to be fairly famous, but you gave them their start. It's just a very strange thing. Can you talk a bit about that? Can you paint that picture in full for us? Because for me, when even listening to some of Dallas's, you know, music since on the radio, it's hard to avoid it. I would say that the song you wrote is my favorite of everything I've ever heard him do. And it had a magical thing. Like, it was clear when we heard that song on the radio all those years ago, 2006, that like, it sparkled with an intensity and a magic that really like connected. And I feel like, I just don't know anything. I don't know another music business story like it, where there's a sort of a writer responsible for an initial hit and then somebody sort of builds on that career in the postlude. Can you paint that picture for us?
Well, Dallas Green was coming from a very famous screamo band called Lexus on Fire that was doing really well. Right. So I certainly would give credit to, you know, all the work that that band did and just blowing up this scene and this genre. Marco DeFelice from Super Garage gave me a demo tape of Dallas's solo project, City in Color, before it was released, and said, you know, this kid can really sing. He's got a great voice. And I was just blown away. I listened to the CD and I was like, wow. So, you know, Never Any White Lights, the idea was to take different artists and put them in sort of a different type of womb and atmosphere. And so I had already set my sights on, you know, Finger 11, Our Lady Peace, and I'm trying to yank these guys out of the pop rock arena and do something cerebral and cinematic and atmospheric and sort of like where it doesn't matter if you've got the 3.5 minute hook or hit. It wasn't, Never Any White Lights was not about, ironically, hit songs or radio or success. It was just like a movie, like a studio project. And when I heard Dallas, I just intuitively felt I had to write something for him specifically for his voice. And I had already written a song before I really got to see what he could do in the studio. And I scrapped it and I wrote The Grace about 20 minutes and we laid it down, and I didn't have any expectations except for that the course felt familiar to me. But you know, the radio people who had heard it said, this is a hit.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, that means and whatever. So, Much Music picked it up immediately in heavy rotation. And my manager called and said, well, your life's going to change today forever. And I'm like, I don't know what that means, you know, because I'm just so detached from the music industry. I didn't really cut my teeth touring or anything. I was just a studio dude, you know. And Much Music really supported that song. And the Edge 102 and all the rock radio stations, even some crossovers, really supported that song. And then it, you know, it hit number one. And so there was this sort of confusion about, is Dallas Green Never Ending White Lights? Is this, who's yeah. Daniel? And I expected that, which again is why it wasn't supposed to be a cookie cutter project. I wanted questions to be asked because I was bored of regular bands just being regular bands. You know, it's like, okay, we can do the indie thing. We get it. But this is cool because, you know, I'm coming in from this side with these ideas, and I'm bringing in these different singers to realize them like actors performing a script. You give the script to a different actor, you get a different, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis is going to do something different than Nick Cage, but they're both genius. So it was fun to watch these songs bloom via the singer that would come in. And Dallas was probably, as you said, a shining, sparkling example of the right song and the right singer. And it just captured hearts, you know, it just hit.
It seems to me, though, like when one sits and dreams about their rock and roll life budding and taking off, that there's a narcissism in that vision, at least in the lore of rock and roll. It's an egotistical game of like that individual fighting the odds to have that individual voice kind of come to the public. So for you, it feels like there's already something selfless or potentially egoless about the idea that you'll create from behind the camera in hopes of creating a set and lights and a script and a movie that features new other stars other than you. Like, it's frankly, it's counterintuitive to sort of the macho rock and roll approach of everybody sit down, I got something to say. So is that who you are? What's like, can you sort of flesh that out?
I wanted to be famous. I wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to be on stage and I wanted to be recognized and well-known. I mean, I had that same sort of ego-driven part of my career, but it was more important to me to create art, to create a conceptual project, an album that I felt didn't exist. It was like, I don't have an album like this.
Yeah.
I will make an album like this, and I will challenge myself to see if I can actually do this as an unknown with no money and no connections. Just a guy who was playing in a pub across the street from the U of W every Friday singing cover songs. You know, I mean, I got sick of the Brown Eyed Girl scene, right? It's like, ba-da-ba-ba-da, you know, people spilling beer on my guitar. I'm like, you know what? I think I want to do something a little different. It was funny because I was bringing in, you know, all these weird effects and stuff into this pub show. And the owner's like, you need to get the hell out of here. So I, you know, I hit the studio and I'm like, you know what? I really do need to make something. And when I came up with the concept for Never Ending White Lights, I didn't want to be the face of it. I wanted to be behind the scenes. I wanted to be the producer, you know, and the writer. And it didn't bother me. I mean, I didn't put my picture in the album. And I had actually asked Dallas Green to be the star of the video. And he actually didn't return my calls at the time, but I was leaving a message saying, you know, Much Music loves you. I'm not a camera guy. And it was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, that I was, you know, I had to act in the video, and all of a sudden I was the persona of what Never Ending White Lights was. And so I had to fill those shoes quite quick, and I didn't know how to be a celebrity or rock star. You know, I had to wear like some of the clothes from the video for a while and really start to understand the aesthetic and the imagery of that, instead of just being, you know, you know, in the t-shirt and jeans in the basement, hacking it out. So it was a life-changing thing to be the face of that. But now I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, and they said that it was going to change your life. You and I chatted about the fact that between when I signed my deal with Universal in 2002, I think, you signed a deal in what, 2005, 2006? When?
About 2005.
Yeah. And then, so we discussed how we straddle this very interesting time period of right around then is when the industry that had been sort of operating within a certain parameter of convention, like for 40 or 50 years, like started to really fall apart. The wheels were coming off and everybody knew it. And there was a lot of long faces at the record label. It was not a fun time to go into the office of the record company because everybody in there felt like the jig was up and that the industry was officially dying and that we were all going to lose our jobs and that no one could figure out exactly what the next step was going to be. I wouldn't say it was a joyful time to be in the industry.
Anxiety ridden.
It was anxiety ridden. Was there pressure coming to you from on high at the label saying, hey, it's harder than ever to move units. We got to make sure that you do something that, you know, we can capitalize on. What were they saying? What kind of crazy stuff were you hearing?
It wasn't at its worst in 2005, 2006, when the Grace was doing really well and my first album was doing really well. They were still selling physical CDs. You could go to HMV and, you know, spend $20 and buy a record. So they hadn't hit the hard times yet. But there was always that sense it was coming since, like, you know, 99-cent downloads and, you know, the early age of Napster. There was always like this, is this really going to happen? And Brick and Mortar was still really, it was still going strong 2005. So I watched from my first record to my third, the tower come down in real time. And everyone at the label, I mean, they're just afraid of losing their jobs. They're not listening to your music in the meeting. You have a meeting, I would play my songs and they're just like, they're nervous and worried about feeding their families. So they're looking at me, well, if you don't have another hit, I'm like, well, I didn't know I had one in the first place. Like, it's not something you can go and formulate.
Right.
The magic that happens when a song connects with an audience and a hit song happens is that's a universal innate sort of guidance and attraction people have to certain art, right? There's like a frequency bond between the listener and the song. And if it strikes a chord, it does really well. The labels never figured that out.
Mm.
Even when I was young, I kind of sensed there's got to be a magic factor here, right? You can't just walk in and predict, you know, this band's going to be huge and this band isn't based on, you know, how they look or that the song gets to the chorus within the first 60 seconds. It was like, I didn't want to get trapped into that, that forcing of who you have to be to sell records. But by my third record, I got a lot of really negative sort of input into my process where people were saying, you know, you're either going to go up or down. Everyone's going to forget about you. If you don't have a hit, no one's ever going to listen to you. And I kind of fell off my path a bit on my third record. And I tried to make an album that was more rock and a little more radio. And ironically, it did the worst. And people really, they could sense that something was amiss with me because if you're not being your true authentic self, people can sense that, you know, and the label didn't care. They just like, you know, don't Boris get to the chorus. Like that's what they would say in the meetings. I'm like, oh my God, you know, like I got in music to not be pressured. I got in music to be exploratory and to have fun. And I wasn't having fun. Because it was bottom dollars and it was, you know, shareholders and it was, you know, it was like, I might as well just go into accounting or real estate at this point because this is not, this isn't the rock star dream at that point.
It's weird because I wouldn't say that, It's funny. Fear is a fuel for my creativity, but not that kind of fear. Not the kind of fear that we're talking about, like where I'm scared to make, where I'm scared to take a risk for fear of not being able to look after myself. I mean, I think when you are an artist, you learn early to get comfortable with risk because risk is just part of the game. In order to make something worth commenting on, you have to, in some ways, put yourself out with a uniqueness that is risky because you want to be noticed for being different. And we all know that sort of in our tribal reality, being noticed for being different can sometimes be dangerous stuff. You know, it's like, oh, we heard you're the different one and we don't like that. So it is fundamental. Like risk is fundamental to the artist's character. And I think that if you are in a corporate job, and I loved all the people at Universal, but I realized after some time that a corporate job is a corporate job. And it's, you know, Universal could have been, you know, it could have been any major corp. And I think that any major corp is populated with people that operate from that place of fear, and it's not necessarily creative. And then I guess and I feel like you and I talked in Windsor that the people who do survive that atmosphere are wired in a certain way that they can hear the pull up your bootstraps kid type message and parlay that into something creative. But that's not everybody that can do that.
No, the industry has a reputation for eating artists alive. And I've signed young artists to my label, and I've created a safe place for them to develop their art without any, you know, rules, regulations of what it has to be. And I wanted to start a music company like that, where that was the focus was be yourself, be authentic. We're going to support you. We're going to bring in investors. And we had a young lad from Vancouver, Evan Conrad, who we signed to our first endeavor. And he eventually ended up signing to Atlantic Lava Records after they heard the record that we did. But it was this real cool place where you can just express who you want to be. And fear was not allowed in the room. And that was from my PTSD being in the industry at the time where they bullied me around, and they were, you know, I'm not a victim. I'm not playing into victim consciousness. I'm saying, you know, there's a way you can do it that feels comfortable and inspiring. And there's a way you can do it that feels like I don't even want to be doing this anymore. So when there's too much pressure on artists, yeah, I mean, even mentally, like I had a lot of mental health problems after, because my gifts, my passions, and my innate sort of life mission was now, it was like bonded to this survival mechanism of like, if you don't sell units, you will fail. If you fail, you can't eat. If you can't eat, you won't survive. And it's ultimately death. So when that got all entangled into my music creation, I quit. That's why in 2013, I stopped making music for several years. I've been out for 13 years now. I haven't put out a song in 13 years. I was so damaged from that bond between having to survive and making art. And it just, those things are not supposed to be intertwined. It's two different areas. Okay. You're out in the field, you know, hunting and gathering and shooting for life, or you're being creative and you're expressing that true divine channeling that you bring in from the other realms when you write a song or when you make art. Those two don't play well. And, you know, it took me a while to sort of unhinge that, but that's part of my journey and I'm still grateful for it.
So we're leading towards where you take a break from music. And in some ways, this is the part of the conversation we had in Windsor that blew my mind. Excuse me. I had been myself sort of investing in some three-dimensional darkness. I was definitely askew, and I was doing this to myself knowing that I ought not to. And then being in your presence, you bathed me in a light that literally shut down the negativity and closed off that third dimensionality and reminded me to start upticking frequency-wise. If you don't mind, I would love to chat about this because I feel like in some ways the fourth act in music that we may still be waiting for, you have been living a fourth act kind of quietly that is extraordinary in my opinion. So are you happy to chat a little bit about what has taken place in the years that you've been off stage, as it were?
Yeah, I hadn't had a chance to really speak about it until you and I sat down and you know, after dinner and we're getting into these sorts of things. I hadn't really shared that story yet.
I mean, it's kind of where I'm at. I think I told you that I had a spiritual rebuild over the last 18 months that I hit the very bottom with sadness, not sadness, fear and anxiety and the self-loathing. And generally, I think there was some victim stuff in there, which is really hard to avoid because that stuff is being peddled very hard these days. So I had to do a major rethink and rebuild. I definitely cycled through a lot of belief systems. And I'm, as I said to you, I have had an astrologer in my life since I was a teenager. So she's been elemental over the years in helping me along in the esoteric spiritual lane of things. And in the last year, she's been hugely important to me. Then you come along with the work you've been doing, and it seems that you're endeavoring down this path at a very, I hesitate to say high level, but it feels like this the way, it's some way I can describe it, a high level. So, okay, I'm going to hand it over to you and we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. Well, at the time that I was experiencing what I would call a dark night of the soul, sort of a very devastating point in my life was when it seemed the universe was abandoning me, that God was abandoning me because I couldn't make a living on my gifts, couldn't make a living on my music. And so I had lost everything, quote unquote. Like, I was still alive, but I mean, like, agents, management, label, fans, people, everything was gone, you know, girlfriend, everything. And I had to do some exploring. And I spent a few years in a dark period where I just thought, like, really, there's no point for me. Like, I was always kind of on the verge of like, God, do I have to get up today and I really have to do this? Like, there's always that part that's like, is there another way out? Like, and I wrote The Grace about the naturalism that we have towards, I don't want to say, you know, to not being here in terms of suicide per se, but just to like escape. Mm-hmm. There was a perpetual longing I always felt that I was uncomfortable here. And I'm like, am I longing for another star system? Am I longing to be dead? Am I longing to be loved? Am I longing for money and fame? I couldn't figure it out. But I realized the fame I had, even on a small scale, didn't fulfill me. And even completing the albums didn't really fulfill me. And people singing my songs didn't fulfill me. So I was like, what is this? So I got sort of shut down for a couple of years. And I had to figure things out, and it got darker and darker and darker. And, you know, alcohol is really the only way to numb some of that, to smooth it out. But it still makes you depressed, it makes you sad, and the hangovers are terrible. So life just got real bad for a few years. And it seemed at one point, looking out the window, it was just blacker than it had been. And there was nobody really there. And that was my furthest sort of detachment from source, like detachment from God, where I really felt, wow, like I'm really not loved. So that was the beginning of the next phase of my life, which was my awakening. In that depression, a friend of mine had recommended a book by Louise Hay called You Can Heal Your Life. And I thought that was really fruity and frilly, and I didn't want to read it because I'm a punk rocker and I want to be like, you know, gritty with it. And I didn't want to do the new age thing. I still think the new age thing's a little bit hokey, right? So I read it one day just to say I read it. And within the first page, I was like, oh my God, there was a resonance there for me, you know, that, essentially, you have more power than you think, and you give your power away to all of these other things, people, places, situations, ex-lovers, money. And then you feel that you're getting beat up when really you're allowing these things to have this power over you. And, you know, we're not trained in the ways to understand how we give our power away. So powerless is a really good way for me to describe how I felt at that time. Like everyone was like, everybody had control of me except for me, you know? So after I started to open up to the idea of love versus fear, or that love and fear are the two expressions, not love and hate, but love and fear, started to audit myself where I was expressing fear in my life versus where I was expressing love. So what is my average reaction when something bad happens? Oh, this always happens. This is terrible. You know, much, you know, this meal cost for dinner and the traffic to get there was terrible. I was like, oh my God, it's like constant complaining. That's a negative, you know, verbalization of my experience, instead of, well, you know what? I'm grateful I have a car that I can get to where I'm going. I'm grateful that I had the ability to have dinner with my friends. I'm grateful that, you know, so it's like gratitude is a whole different vibration than complaining. So I started to tidy up all of the sort of negative aspects of my life, and things really changed really fast. Within about a year, I was a completely different person, and I was doing what I call the this technique where you flip everything if it's negative before you say it. You know, so if I'm going to complain about something, I'd catch myself and say, no, say the opposite of that, you know. And now this is all very superficial stuff, but that's the basis for getting to the next level of things, is you have to start understanding you become the frequency of the words you say, the thoughts you think, right? And so that taught me a lot about thinking and where our thoughts come from. And I'm like, well, you know what? Like, I'm around a lot of people that do complain or that are negative. And I grew up with a lot of that sort of like, the world's kind of heavy and it's always on my shoulders. It's like, no wonder that's my default go-to. So I worked at changing that. And I read a lot of books, watched a lot of videos, and journaled a lot. And I just really tried to shift to a place where everything was loving. And then you realize that, well, you have traumas. So even though every day you can make a point to say a positive affirmation, yeah, there's still trauma from when you were 3 years old and the teacher yelled at you or whatever, your parents were mean to you. You watched other people suffer. You were traumatized, whatever. So I started to understand and learn about trauma healing. And that's a very scary ride, because you have to be very raw and honest when you go back and re-examine everything that's ever happened to you that you hated, and that's still happening to you that you hate. And you realize that there is an idea that you might be creating these things. We can say attracting them, but creating them so that you can understand which parts of you are out of alignment with where you really want to be. So how else would you be shown this unless it's reflected back to you in your everyday life? People that are, you know, bad people, or they've done you wrong, or you would go in and audit the situation and say, okay, what aspect of myself is in this person that ripped me off yesterday, or that didn't want to return my calls, or that treated me poorly? And, you know, I mean, people call it shadow work, you know, self-work, whatever. So after a lot of time there, I was able to clear the traumas. So now we're getting up to another. So every time you do these things, you're basically getting to another frequency. And it's almost like never done, you know? So I got to a point where I was like, okay, so I've got the love thing. I've cleared the fear thing. So you're not afraid of dying. You're not, you understand the difference between worrying, survival-based thoughts, and loving, grateful thoughts. Then you do the trauma healing, the shadow work. And then what happened was I was ready for an awakening, like a real hardcore spiritual awakening, which is going to rip you out of the matrix. So that is probably the most horrifying thing I've ever experienced. And I don't have a word to describe it. It was awful. And it still continues to be very challenging. When you're ripped from the matrix, everything is an illusion. And everything that you experience isn't real. And now you have to come to terms with all of these things that you thought you were. And this is the dismantling of the ego self, right? The identity. You know, I created and constructed an identity. And then you have to undo all of those things and get down to the root, which is emptiness, nothingness. It's just 0 point. It is a oneness in a sense with all things. It's a oneness with, you know, with God, source, creator, however you want to call it. And I had a, it was a very, I don't want to say alarming. It was a very obvious awakening for me because I was starting to see signs everywhere. You know, you start to get these synchronicities. And I had a couple supernatural sort of experiences in my sleep. And then I would wake up and I would draw these things and I would find that I had been drawing these images and they all lined up. And I was prompted to go reevaluate my lyrics from my first album. And I went back and reread them and I was like, oh my God, it's all in there. Every song and lyric. I wasn't conscious of it then. I was just, you know, 22 years old writing songs. That album is like a subconscious journal for me, you know, and I had that song, you know, this longing, this endless longing as it was before. Would you settle for a wasted life? Even the course of the grace, you know, put me where I belong. It's like there's something else I'm leaving breadcrumbs for my awakened self to see what's real and what's not and what I'm doing here. And that's completely removed from commerce, money, business. It's that's the me that is on the spiritual mission to be here to fulfill what my soul wants me to fulfill, which is twofold. It's to release as much creative output as I can musically, to encode frequencies in the song so that they can help people on that frequency, and to be a light in the wisdom that's coming through from the channel I work with, which we can get into and stuff, to help spread a sort of light frequency across the planet for the shift that's happening right now.
I do want to talk about your medium. This is fascinating. This is this is exactly what I was hoping we would chat about. But at this juncture, I want to ask you about Jonah and the whale, because I'm trying to understand what the impetus is to go through this if there's no, you know.
Yeah.
Jonah when God called, said no thanks and jumped off, you know, a ship and then was swallowed by a whale. And it was like, okay, I guess God's like really pushing this. So I better get down to doing the business of what it is God's asking me. I guess when I hear some of the initial undulations of this coming into your life, I'm like, why wouldn't you just run away from all this? Like, and then you said that you were called to look at the lyrics again. So you're following a voice, you're following a feeling, you're all of a sudden you're in a new relationship of trust with your inner self, I'm guessing. But really the image I'm interested in is, why didn't you run away from this? Why weren't you a Jonah? Like, and that you just decided you would pursue this despite the heaviness, the weight, and the pain that you were going to go through to arrive where we're about to discuss you sort of hooking up with your this medium. But I'm just curious, why did you follow this?
Two reasons. One, you have no choice. Your other choice is to you know, take pills and die, which is not on my agenda. The reason, Hawk, is because resistance to anything is resisting yourself. So I'm not going to resist what I'm getting, because I'd be resisting the purpose I came here to live. So when you fight against what you get, it just creates this huge ball of black energy that just spirals out of control, and your life gets worse and worse and worse. So when I did decide this was too much for me, like for me to go on this spiritual journey and for me to transform, we're talking complete transformation during this time. And obviously I'll talk about the medium and how she's helped me. But we're talking about a complete rebirth where I've been doing these sessions with these beings of light to help me be reborn into a new body. I'm talking new DNA, a new nervous system. So, physiology, biology, new neural pathways, like everything has been changed now. And I didn't want that to happen because it was uncomfortable. I knew it was going to be uncomfortable. But when I resisted, it got worse. Because in my resistance, it's like I'm being pressured to follow the path of my soul. So your alignment, when everything feels good, is when you're aligned with your soul. That's what your intuition is. I like this restaurant better than I like this restaurant. Well, why do you have an opinion? There's something guiding you all the time. Why does this person feel better to be around than this person, right? Follow that alignment. So if I was going to resist this, I'd be going against my soul, I'd be going against my higher self and my mission. And the beings I work with had said to me a couple times, this is going to get really uncomfortable for you if you don't play ball, because you came here for this mission. Now, why would you want to go back on your mission? And I was drinking to cope with a lot of these uncomfortable feelings. And they sort of slapped my wrist on that and said, you know, we know it's fun to drink and stuff, but you're going to have to watch out because you're here for a specific purpose. Do you want to help people? Yeah. Would you want to be of service to others? Yeah. Well, then toughen up, tighten up, get to work. So I didn't run and I didn't resist because I wanted to fulfill my mission and because going against the soul is going to be really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's funny. My astrologer Rose in my last session a couple of weeks ago was talking about, I mean, she's a believer. She's all destiny over power, personal choice. Like for her, your astrological chart is more or less the contract you sign when your soul decides to come down to this dimension and have this experience. And the more you resist the path of your chart, in her opinion, the harder it is for you to live. Like in some ways, your chart, the destiny, the picture of your destiny is contained within that contract.
Yeah. And it's you made it.
You made right. it. You're responsible. That's why there should be no victimhood down here, because the soul made this decision. Is that right?
When you're born under the veil, you forget that you made the decisions to have a sort of life path and you forgot. So you feel victimized because negative things or bad things happen. But we try to look at things as neutral, and we try to look at things that are unwanted as catalysts, like crisis would be a catalyst, like something really bad happens. Okay, there's something that needs changing here. The foundation this was created on is no good anymore, you know? The earth experience is a bit of a school, and you're not really here to just have a good time the whole way through, because that's what you already have that in the fifth dimension, higher dimensions. You have love and light and you have harmony and everything's wonderful. You can manifest instantly. Earth is like the punk rock show where you might get like, you're thrown in the pit. You know, we're not going to see like the orchestra or Yanni up here where everything's peaceful. It's rock and roll. So, you know, things get messy. And if you resist that, it's way harder for you. If you're a victim to it, it's way harder for you to get through, right? So that's why I try to not enable people to play the victim role. You know, even if you've had abusive parents, or even if you've had really bad experiences, well, you know, they did that to me. It's like, well, it's possible that you chose this before you were born to have the experience to see if you could overcome this through love, through forgiveness, through compassion, through objective observation, you know. And these are some of the things about Christ consciousness, if you want to say, like, you know, like compassion and service to others and turning the other cheek and stuff. It's like, well, if you were abused, would you have it in you to forgive and use compassion that person acted out of a lack of love themselves? Because any unloving act comes from a void of love. So any abuser is just missing love. So that almost makes you want to love them more. Mm. They need extra hugs, right? They don't need us to fight them and villainize them. But that is one of the tests of mastery. Because when it happens to you, you know, how ready are you going to be to forgive? Somebody screws up your family or messes with you. It's like, you know, you have that instinct that you hate them or you're against them, but it's a test. It's always a test. And we get tested on this life path until our soul has accumulated the experience it wanted to have on this mission. And there are thousands of reincarnations and missions. And every time you reincarnate, you are bringing with you what you've learned and gained in the past experiences.
Yeah. Vis-a-vis those people who are old souls, this is somewhat explaining the return with past experiences being still imprinted on the soul. This, what you had talked about when negative things happen in this dimension, on this earthly experience, that there's some probability that we signed up for this experience before we got here. And my astrologer, Rose, would say the same thing, that we travel in almost soul packs, and that as we reincarnate over the thousands of times, we inevitably drift towards souls that are kind of our literal soul mates. And then, you know, if you do tangle with somebody on this planet in this experience, in this dimension that is negative, there's a good chance that you guys are soul buddies off planet, and this was a contract you created with somebody, trusting that you could go through a negative experience and share that opportunity for that experience. Is this kind of consistent with your thoughts as well?
Yeah. And you would trade roles in the next incarnation. Next time I'll be the abuser, you be the victim.
Interesting.
It's like, because essentially that is all consciousness expressing itself into every potential it can reach. Mm. At the point of consciousness where your physicality is focused, you are serving the greater whole by having the experience of being the abuser, the victim or not, to see where that path can go. And also to see, you know, how far into darkness some of these things can go before coming back to the light, or if it's even a choice to come back to the light. You know, it's said that everything is returning to the higher realms, to the higher frequencies, right back to source. But, you know, it's sort of taking that long way around. By the time we get to Earth, and I've said this to you before, right? We're at the furthest. Mm.
Sorry, Daniel. Zoom just clipped your voice. This was, when you said this, a light went on in a part of me that has not gone off. And I just want to make sure that it's heard about the third dimension and God. So please, one more time.
The physical Earth experience, when you're born here in 3D, you are under the veil of illusion of being separate from all things, from being separate from consciousness, from being separate from source, God, create. This dimension exists all over the galaxy, all over the universe, not just on Earth, right? You can be three-dimensional on Mars. It doesn't matter. In this experience, you're the furthest in separation from God that you can get. That's what the third dimension is created for. And the result of this, as you can see, is that nobody knows what the hell's going on. And so man creates religions, and there's multiple religions. And, well, we believe this, and we believe, because nobody knows. And I always wondered growing up why it wasn't tattooed on our wrist, where we're from, why we're here, where we're going. well, I have to become an agnostic and then an atheist. And then I got to, you know, have a vision one day and then become a Christian because my mom baptized me. Like, it's very confusing. And when you have spiritual discussions with religious people, they're defending a faith over another faith. It's like, well, neither of you know or knew, because I was born here too. It's not tattooed in your head. It might be in your heart, right, when you discover it. But the instruction manual is in here. It's a separation game. So you have to play this out to see if you can get back to finding wholeness, oneness, and that inner alignment with your higher self, your soul, and all consciousness through your journeys here of being cut off. It's like the great race, or like someone likened it to being on a ride at Disney, where you pay for a ticket and go on the wild ride. And, you know, like, it's scary, but you wanted it to be scary. So for that little bit of time, you suspend belief and you let it go, and because you know you're safe. So that's kind of like being on Earth. Like, we're always protected. We're always safe. We're not really going to die, right? And you think you are. Mm. So it creates action. If you knew this when you're here, there's nothing to do. There's no spark. There's no like you actually think you're going to die now. So it's like, oh my God, like you got to do all these things and accomplish, you know. But that's awakening it while in the third dimension is an understanding of this. So it's stepping out of the matrix and seeing the construct of the matrix, what its purpose is, understanding that not everybody will wake up to that, because they're either not interested in that, not ready for that, or their soul has other plans for them. But as I mentioned to you when we talked about 2012, you know, ending the Piscean age and beginning the age of Aquarius, you have now a global shift for humanity, all raising their frequency. And that's why you've seen so much exposure of these dark forces and corruption. And it's manifesting in all these ways, where the old foundation in what we would call lack, limitation, scarcity, these are three-dimensional matrix templates, right? They make up the matrix of the third dimension. Oh, there's not enough to go around. So 1% has all the wealth. That's a scarcity imprint. It's not real. It's only if you're in the third dimensional dream do you think it's real, right? And we all did. I mean, I still do sometimes, right? So when you exit that, you understand, oh, actually, there's abundance for all. Lack, limitation, scarcity are their designs in that game. And I have had I have no word for this, but divine privilege, pleasure, and joy of speaking to this month beings from about upper 12th dimension, light beings, but no bodies, who could only describe themselves as the architects of the matrix and the engineers of the matrix. And they came in a channeling session that I was attending, and they explained to us that humans ask us, or the soul would ask us, to create these imprints, programs, and templates for the game of Earth when you come in here, because they wanted to experience scarcity, lack, fear, limitation. And you would think now, like, why would I want that?
Yeah.
But I can't assume or try to figure out what a fifth dimensional me or soul would want. I can't. It's outside the veil. So there's a lot of things that we don't know, quote unquote, why it happens. So my best guess would be maybe this is just, you know, an experience all consciousness wants to have. Maybe the soul wanted to go on a roller coaster ride and pretend it wasn't already God. I don't know, but it's a playing field here. And you know, when you understand that, you take things a little less seriously.
Yeah.
And you can to work at the parts of your life that you want to focus on, instead of being, you know, held back by the things that you thought were out of your control.
It's so heavy. It's everything you're talking about has been the sort of the thrust of my life the last year and a half or more. I mean, I've always had a room reserved in the, you know, the mansion of my soul for this kind of thing. But in the last few years, it's been crystallized in a way that I can see into it as a, I can see into its realness, for lack of a better way of putting it. And I think I told you some of this stuff that in the cycling through the belief systems, a very emotional year and a half, only to settle in a place where I do feel that within the context of the simulation theory image, as I see it, the zillions of ribbons of potential lives you can live, I feel like I tripped over a few lives just by endeavoring to push some of this stuff that you're talking about. I mean, you've done it at in a level that I can't even claim to fully understand, but I feel like I've changed myself enough that I'm no longer fear dominant. In fact, I believe that I haven't been tested, but I feel that my relationship to fear is completely changed. I don't fear death in near the way I did for most of my life. If you want to talk a trauma, it's possible that when I was 4 or 5, I was diagnosed with a potentially deadly kidney thing. I went to Sick Kids. All the parents were crying. Everybody was crying. It turned out to be nothing in the end. But, you know, was this the fear motivator that was set in me? Because I feel like I went out of my way to practice and get good at what I did, believing that my mortality was lurking, that I was going to die any moment. When I was a kid, I have a clear memory of being in kindergarten and knowing something great lived inside of me. And then I knew I'd have to serve it. And so part of me was like, if I die, I can't serve this thing that I know is there. It's another reason why I didn't drink or do drugs in high school, is that I was very protective, knowing that this thing was in me. And I felt like I needed to not alter it. That, of course, was all thrown out the door when I got into the music business and drugs and alcohol became sort of part and parcel to playing out the archetypal narrative of a rock and roll guy, self-destructive, blah, blah, blah. So when I quit drinking, it was the beginning of the end of some of that old self-loathing, deep victimhood stuff. Coming from the 90s, the afternoon television scheme in some ways perfected the idea of letting us all join the victim league. I feel like when I was sick from school at home, afternoon television, Oprah, whatever was on was very much about identifying your victimhood, celebrating your victimhood, and more or less flying the victimhood flag as a central piece to self-understanding. And I feel like I was there for 2 decades, and boy, is that an empty place to be. And I feel like we're still in the middle of that big sales pitch on victimhood. And I feel like there couldn't be anything more self-destructive than engaging in that. So I'm very interested in these light beings in the 12th dimension that say they are the constructors of the matrix, because of course, with all of the leaps forward in quantum computing and physics, and we're thinking big in a way that now we understand that at the deepest places of math, of physics, it looks a lot more like magic than it does look like anything imperial. So when you start to unpack some of these things, I feel like now I'm a part of the most wonderful and exciting adventure. Like, it's a life that is far more interesting to me to live than the 2500 sort of the narrative that was sold to us in public school as this is how it works. Even when I was a kid, I was like, I'm resistant to all this. I mean, I'm a natural contrarian to begin with, but I was like, there's just no way half of this stuff is the way it really happened. My stomach was always very resistant to these ideas.
I had stomach problems too, for the same reason. I was uncomfortable with that story. You know, your whole life, you have to do what you're told. There's certain guidelines and rules. And then maybe you can retire when you're 75 and you not get cancer and try to stay alive. And, you know, there's pharmaceutical commercials on every day for all sorts of stuff. And it's like, what am I just trying to dodge illness? You know, am I just trying to achieve financial security? Like, none of that made sense to me growing up. And it was very hard to believe in my heart because everyone else was playing the game. Everywhere you go, everyone's playing the game. School and you know, everywhere. So, you know, I kind of felt cast out as an alien, as I'm sure you did. You just felt like an alien. Artists are like that, but everyone has that inside. It just depends on how invested and how deep down in the matrix you've allowed yourself to get. But it's not our fault if we start school at 5 and we're already in that system and the brick walls and the long days and, you know, they give you a book and say, this is how it happened and this is how it is. You can't say, can I, you know, offer new information? No, we're going to tell you how it is, right? So we don't question anything. So we sink further and further into that matrix, right? Unless you get cracked at some point in your life. That's what some of these light beings call it. Like, you humans need to be cracked out of that spell that you're under. You'll live your whole life in that little rat maze, that fishbowl. And there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But if you observe that a lot of people feel anxiety and they feel uncomfortable and they're like, ah, they all have that nagging longing inside that there's something more than the 9 to 5, than the retirement, than, you know, the education we received, you know? And what that is that there's a deep inner knowing that already exists that knows everything. So it starts to kind of bleed through you sometimes, you know? That's why when you get your second education after school, if you so choose to start, as you are, researching new things, learning new things, you'll realize that you knew everything all along and you just remember it. So it's an unlearning of the doctrine, programming, fear, beliefs, everything that, and it's not the teacher's fault or the government's fault. That's the 3D setup for that game. It's like, and I always talk about video games, but it's like playing Super Mario Brothers and you're mad that there's like obstacles. You can't get mad at the little, you know, Goomba that's trying to eat you. It's there because it's part of the design. You want to jump over it and get to where you're going. So we don't blame anybody. But as you expand your wisdom, understanding, and learning, you start, this remembering starts to seep through. You're like, oh yeah, I'm a cosmic being. Oh yeah, you know what? Yeah, oneness feels better than separation. Right? Because 3D reality is a big separation game. It's me versus you, them versus us. But that never really works out because then, you know, an eye for an eye type thing. And I was always puzzled by how this applied to me working in the music industry and how the banks treated people and stuff. It's like, shouldn't we be working together? And I don't mean communism. I'm not talking about any sort of like, I just mean like if everybody was of service to everybody else, we would all be doing well. Because the second you start to hoard or start to be fearful of, well, some, you know, it's like someone else loses and it's, that's gotten us to where we are. And it's been a fun ride, but things are shifting now. So with the new learning, what people are going to understand is the new quantum reality of things, which is a different science. And this isn't about separating everything because everything's entangled, right? Talk about quantum entanglement and things. You can't, you know, put spirituality over here and science over here and, you know, geometry, math over here and living a good life over here. It's all part of the same thing. And we're going to get to that eventually. I think the next 1,000 years, right, we're heading into the next phase of like heaven on earth and the evolution of humanity into the fifth dimension. But in that quantum field, everything is affected by frequency. And matter as a solid thing goes away. And we were taught like that matter's solid, right? It's that Newtonian physics thing, you know. And, you know, it's turns out it's not true. It's all particles vibrating at that quantum level. It's just open sort of space. And in pops physical form through frequency. So we start to look at ourselves as energetic beings instead of physical and solid. Now you've unlocked the secrets to wellness and health, because you're not treating a physical body, you're treating an energetic body. And now you're looking at what types of things do I believe, think, and say that could be affecting my frequency and lowering my vibration that is allowing illness and disease to come in at that low frequency, right? Because once you get to, like, you know, 50 hertz or whatever upwards, there's no illness. If you're at the if you vibrate at the frequency of love, you cannot get sick. And at that frequency, if you hold that frequency, you also will not age, and you will reverse. Like, there's no entropy, there's no decay in the body. And that's the only difference between, quote unquote, the angels in heaven and us, is just the density. We're just at a lower frequency, right? But we were never, we were never taught to see things as frequency. We were never taught to see things as energy. So that's the next phase. And it's going to be really exciting to see these things start to come to, like, the mainstream. But how humanity progresses is dependent on how willing people are to let go of their belief structures. And you will find introducing new information to somebody who's built an identity on a belief structure will create that cognitive dissonance, will create that discomfort, and they will move you out of the way. They don't want to hear it. So that's what I was saying about being cracked, is that until something really cracks you wide open, a lot of people stay in that sort of that closed circuit, and that's part of their journey. But life does get more difficult when people are being called to open up. It's like opening your mind, releasing the identity that you've built on your belief constructs, not being afraid to ditch your belief constructs and start from scratch, from a place that's essentially, I don't know anything. You know, like, I really don't know. Let's just start from scratch and see where my intuitive guidance leads me. And the two best things to follow, and we talk about this too, if you don't know where to go or what's going to lead you to your to the next step of your wisdom, is to follow your excitement, is to follow what excites you and do everything that is most fulfilling and exciting for you in the next moment. And then the next moment will lead you to what's meant for you. You might find a book, a friend, a podcast, a song, a movie. This might spark an idea. Oh, I want to write a script. Oh, that feels good. You know, and then you write a script and this feels fun. Because we were taught to do the things we don't like, people are used to doing what's difficult and just thinking it's okay. Right? Well, life's hard. That's the way it is. It's actually not. That's just a belief construct. You could also choose to say, you know, there's a reason why I'm excited. There's a reason why I feel passionate. There's a reason why I'm intuitively guided to do certain things, as opposed to the other thing. Follow that and you can't go wrong. It's built into the system.
It's so big and exciting to hear you talk about this stuff. I feel like I've had a couple of waves of light just come over me. And this happened when we were talking before. Can you talk about the medium you've been working with in Australia?
Yeah. Georgia Jean is an incredible channel. And also a really great friend. She's been channeling a group of beings that are off planet. I think upper 6 to 8 dimensional. They are a group of light. I think they're a multiple group of light beings that work together called the Circle of Light. And when I started reading channeled books and getting into more channeled material, I was excited that this information was coming from somewhere else, because I figured all the information I've read here was from a human who has the same distortions that I do, or that all humans do. There's that same limitation. Even professors and, like, therapists, like, I've been to therapy. It's like, well, can I get something not in the human, you know, matrix of it? So I started reading channeled books and watching this incredible series on Gaia television, which is like the Netflix of spiritual stuff. And there's a show called Interviews with Extra Dimensionals. Now, we call them extra dimensionals, not terrestrials, because they're not in physical form. So I saw Georgia and was transfixed by her message, which is the channeled message from the light beings. And I booked a session with her, and she had this sort of mental, spiritual, soul epiphany about our relationship, that it was meant to sort of, she was meant to guide me to my next level. And so we started working together very closely. We became really, really close friends. And I started doing sessions with the Circle of Light like multiple times a week for 3 years. And the Circle of Light, they know everything about me. Things I don't even tell Georgia. They know what's going on. They are in touch with my higher self. So they often deliver me direct information from my higher self. If I'm drinking too much, they'll say, you know, you don't have to listen to us, but your higher self is trying to tell you, you need to change some things. And so the information that's come from them has been beyond anything I could have humanly understood. And I've had questions and questions and questions over the years, and they answer everything before you can even say it. They know what you're going to say, you know? So they've explained a lot of what humanity's going through right now. You know, and they explained key points to get me through a series of what they call gateways of frequency so that I can properly do my work. And they told me that my initial run with my old albums, and that I would have self-destructed and imploded, and I wouldn't have been able to handle any further success. So they tested me then, and they knew that. So they cracked me down until I had this awakening process, and they've worked with me at every stage. Now, a lot of these sessions, there's vomiting, there's severe unwellness. Some of it feels like you've taken drugs, like you're really exhausted and you can't move. And I guess what I would call like ascension symptoms, which is like the symptoms of increasing your consciousness really fast, is really rough. I mean, I was in the hospital a few times, but they didn't see anything. And so the Circle, they've been my guides for the past 3 years. And I meet with them every week, and they bring me the latest information of what's happening and where we need to go, what we don't need to worry about, what we need to focus on. And so, I mean, I recommend to anybody who's interested, I mean, anybody can book sessions with channels. If you're open to it and your heart is open enough that you can receive what's coming in, it could be really beneficial.
To me, I would say that there's been a spiritual bent to my entire life. I feel like I've got a Christian imprint on me from this life and probably several recent past lives. You know, we have a worship imprint. We have a lot of funny things, little isms that we drag into this existence and this into this experience, this game that you're calling it, which is in some way, that's another lovely way of thinking about it, because we carry the weight of this life in this veil. We think this is a one-shot deal. And if you invest in an atheistic thinking, you invest in the idea that this is one ride, and once it's over, you go back to dust, and it was all for naught. I mean, and that never really flew with me, because as a kid, singing these devotional songs in church, like I could sense something extraordinary was playing out, not sense in a way that I could articulate, but my being was tuned into things that felt magical, special, important, distant, thoughtful. I definitely, entangling with alcohol and drugs for some years, I feel like that self-destruction is very much a dungeon self-torture in this third dimension of my own creation.
Interject, because the thing with alcohol and drugs is that, let's say you're a starseed. Let's say you are from another star system incarnate here. To deal with the density of Earth that you're uncomfortable with, you're going to look for something. Alcohol and drugs are readily available and very easy to soothe that part of you that's uncomfortable with this density. See, for me, I was used to the star system where I was from, and nothing here made sense to me, but you know, whatever. So alcohol for me was, and even the circle told me, they're like, it's a lot of beings, a lot of humans use this to bring them down into that Earth experience because they're uncomfortable with it. So there's no fault or shame or nothing wrong with seeking that comfort. It's just that it can obviously be addicting and unhealthy, but yeah.
And here you go. And this was how our conversation was like at dinner. Like, this is even hearing you talk about this, talk this stuff through. I know from somebody who's tried to teach guitar, you know, I know how deep you are in this because you can speak about it with a natural, you're natural with this. To me, it's in you in a way that I feel like you're meant to be delivering this. I feel like your comfort, the way you have discussed this whole time, I hate to say it, it's believable, which because bringing this kind of thinking to a very strict three-dimensional situation that we find ourselves in this 21st century, like there's going to be resistance to this idea. You already have, we've mentioned about the soul's resistance to change. And I, in fact, in another podcast was kind of talking about my thoughts around ego, or if it's even a demonic spirit that's put in charge of protecting your belief system, because when your belief system gets pricked with a new idea, you tend to have, at least from friends and family that I know, you know, around the dinner table, you bring up an uncomfortable idea or thought, and the resistance isn't just simple resistance. It's often violence. It's like a demon has been called to stand in place of and to protect that belief system.
Yeah. What I'll say to that is I wouldn't call it a demon. What I would say is that your survival system is doing its job hardcore. Your ego has to keep you safe. And if you're alive and breathing right now, it means everything that you've done to get you to this point worked. So why would you go and listen to Huxley's new idea or this show you saw that talked about aliens on the moon? No. Stay where you are because we're alive. So the ego, there's no demon here. The ego is doing its freaking job. The ego has to keep you alive. This, the what we call like, it's the nervous system, the function to keep you alive. So any new information that doesn't match up is immediately thrown away. Now at the dinner table, that looks like Uncle Ron's an asshole. And he's like, oh, you're not open-minded, dude. It's like, no, his ego's doing his survival system's doing its job, keeping him safe. So it's okay. And we don't want to trash the ego because the ego's helped us to be safe. It says, you know, it's weary and it's always suspicious. But now we might not need it anymore when you're ready to transcend it. And it comes with you. Right? You just observe when it speaks to you. Oh, that's the ego talking. It's afraid of this. So you just, you use your heart. Basically, your heart becomes your new brain. The heart center becomes the new brain. And the mind works with the heart. So the way that you would sort of put that into practice is you use your brain to do menial tasks like driving, right? Entering phone numbers, credit cards. But it doesn't make decisions for you because it's going to freeze you into a place that is safe. You don't necessarily need to be in a place that is safe. You want to be where your soul's really guiding you to be. So you have to basically surrender to the heart center. And surrendering, you know, that's a huge part of exiting that game and exiting the matrix is you don't have to have control over the outcome. You can't anyway. I was trying to control everything. Let it go, right? So you sink into the heart. You trust that your heart has its own blueprint for all the things that you want to experience in life. You know what gets in the way of that? The mind, the thoughts, the thinking, the rumination, the questioning, constant rumination. I don't know. Well, you know, that guy didn't do it successfully. I don't know if I can start a business. Like what? Like it? It's because the ego will say, "Oh, I want to open up a restaurant. I can't do it because all these people failed. You'll never move forward." The heart wants to open the restaurant because it's excited about it. Well, I got to be logical. No, the logical mind will 9 times out of 10 shoot your dreams in the foot because it just wants you to stay in that safe zone. So what do to create balance? Well, we take antidepressants and we have anxiety because we're not following our intuition. We really want to do this, but we don't. We stay in the relationships we don't want to be in. We stay in the jobs you don't want to be in. We self-medicate. We watch sports. We binge Netflix. We distract ourselves. And it's so hard for people to just sit still and surrender to that inner voice and say, you know, what do you want? What do you really want? And that it's okay to want those things and that you can take steps to creating the life that you want through that. But the mind will try to stop you because it's its job. So that's what's happening with these people that are resistant. So essentially, new information, let's say this podcast is new information. It's coming down the pipeline. It's going to be out in the world. No one's going to click on this that's not meant to hear it, because it's not in their frequency range and it's not in their creation manifestation path. So it exists only on that plane for you and me and everybody that's going to be joining us. And if someone's curious, they can essentially take certain things that resonate and leave what doesn't. Because you always have that choice to say, you know what, I like this part, but I don't like this part. Because you're always kind of customizing your belief structures anyways. I'm here to tell people that all your belief structures are just your own creation at some level. So be observant of how you decide to construct yourself because you're choosing it anyways. And a lot of people say, well, no, there's one truth and there's one this. Well, there is and there isn't, right? It's like you kind of stitch together everything that you like and don't like, and then this becomes your life and this becomes your path. But it's good to be aware that you're doing it, right? Because you don't have to believe in the David Icke stuff. You don't have to believe in reptilians and the agenda, the monarchy, but it might be fun too. And it might help you get to certain places. Like for me, all of that darker stuff helped me to understand separation and duality on this planet. You know, I got very sick about the reptilian archonic agenda. So at some point I was told, you know, maybe you don't need to dwell in that. Keep your frequency up and let other people play in that realm as they want. It just depends how it's serving you, how it makes you feel.
Woo! Daniel. Oh boy. You did it again. I'm going to let you go. You've blown my mind again, and I'm so grateful for this discussion. I feel like this is very important stuff as we're being led. No, there's victimhood again. This is a message I feel that I need to hear, and it's important to me. I feel this is the journey I'm on. You're reinvigorating and buttressing a lot of beliefs systems that I'm putting in place currently. You are doing it with an effortlessness and a confidence and a beauty. Like I said, I've had at least two waves of light come over me, and it happened when we were in Windsor as well. It's almost like the fence that got trampled down so that I was going back to, as you say, playing in those dark places, you sort of put the fence back up and put me back in the safe spot. And my soul for the rest of that tour felt clean again. So I'm grateful for this discussion. And thanks, Daniel. I really am grateful for this discussion. Like you said, anybody who's listening to this was meant to was meant to hear it.
And we're here to be vehicles to share these things, because you have a platform that you can put this out, you know, that you can share your ideas. And that's what artists do, and people with podcasts and channels. So, you know, I'm really grateful that you've included me, and this is, it's amazing.
Yeah. Bless you, Daniel. Thanks very much. Thanks for dealing with some of the tech stuff off the top. I hope we'll do this again. I'm very interested to hear reactions from listeners, because you've crystallized eloquently what I would not be able to, but I feel like you've basically painted the picture of the path that I'm on, and that I feel like we're all being called. Look, one more thing. What do you know about Pluto? Rose is talking a lot about Pluto return, and that Pluto, you know, I know it's been decommissioned as a planet in the Newtonian scientific sphere, as you, I think, put it earlier. But from her sort of astrological perspective, Pluto can kind of be a brutal changer for that Pluto is kind of on its return to change things to the thing they're supposed to be, whether those things want to be changed or not. Rose has kind of been encouraged me to say, like, look, here are some of the changes you need to make. It'd be wise if you made them on your own, as opposed to letting Pluto kind of come in and brutalize you into the thing you're supposed to be. Is any of this resonating with you?
Yeah, all of the planets have very specific attributes and characteristics, and they're living beings like we are. They're alive. They're, you know, we're human. They're planetary. They're creations. And when they're expressing a sort of, you know, an attribute, it's more dominant or stronger, we will feel those certain things. So if you look up the different attributes of these planets, you can sort of gauge what's happening in your life. And I know astrology over the years had kind of been, you know, woo-woo, but it's actually really true. Like, it really has an effect. And Pluto, you know, I don't know if it's the great destroyer, or the great changer, what it does bring a lot of, you know, shift. But we're going through that now. Earth's going through that now since 2012. So the next 10 years, buckle up. You know, they're predicting contact in 2026, like open cosmic understanding that we're not alone, because we need to reconnect with our cosmic family. We need to understand the celestial effect, and that we're part of a greater universal galactic, you know, part of creation. And it's like all of those beings have allowed humans to kind of just be in that little game, and they're not intervening because they can't intervene with what you want to play out here. But we're sort of going to, you've heard about disclosure and all these things that are supposed to be coming. So what I heard was that 2026 is supposed to be some kind of understanding, with the world to be ready for it without being, you know, fear mongering that they think they're going to be under attack. And by 2032, the dismantling that Pluto is bringing in is probably going to be coming to a close. And that's going to be the beginning of the building of the golden age of the higher version of Earth. It's being deconstructed right now. It's being deconstructed. Everything that was built in the old energy is being deconstructed so we can have this beautiful, you know, heavenly sort of loving existence. But not everybody will choose to be on that path, because it's still up to you and the soul to do what it wants. So you may find that people are falling out of your life, and new people might be coming into your life that are more aligned with your timeline, and everyone's on a different timeline. And yeah, so it's yeah. What I hear, there's going to be a lot more wild things happening. Kind of like the COVID thing was wild, you know, the pandemic, everything is shut down, and that was part of this sort of shift where people needed to start, you know, need more time to self-reflect, to be alone, to question the things that they're doing, and it highlighted a lot of things in people. And there might be something else coming like that, like another pandemic or lockdown. I'm not sure, but there's supposed to be some kind of major trigger point that kind of sets the tone for the next phase, which is contact. And then the next phase, which is establishing a world that is, you know, functioning above lack, limitation, scarcity, and all those old programs. And we'll be here for that, which is cool.
Heavy.
Yeah.
Heavy. Heavy, Daniel. Woo. Okay. Thank you so much for this. Really, I appreciate it very much. I guess we'll call that. We'll call it a chat. I'm grateful. Yeah, you've turned me upside down in a way that I will leave this conversation feeling 30 times more positive and more excited to be alive than when I entered it. And this is what happened when I saw you in Windsor. So grateful. Thanks again, buddy.
Love you, buddy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Thanks again.
Thank you. Are you still recording?
Oh, I guess I'm still recording. Yeah, no. But I will let you go. Man, that was wonderful.
I love talking to you. I love the questions, and it's so great. You're just such a great spirit, and not to mention, you know, I'm such a fan of all your work all these years, and it's like super cool for me. So
you are a great spirit, Daniel, man. That's just heavy. Like I said, just to quickly follow up on me saying something was believable. I know how hard it is to teach something. Like, I'm an excellent drummer, but it's still hard. You have to really, 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 really know something to teach it. And it's coming out of you like a person who really, 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 really knows it. Like, I think that's the thing, is that, like, you're crystallizing these things in images and with ideas. Like, you are handing me the stuff I need in ways that I can see it in Technicolor. Like, and I'm sure you know that, but you're handing me crisp, three-dimensional, like Viewmaster, like, oh shit, like.
I found it was hard at times to make sense of all of this as I was going through it. So I feel I'm here to kind of organize it a little for me, I'm the regular guy. And a lot of the stuff was always so hard to understand that, like, that's why I wrote my book, to be really, like, you know, like, you can understand punk rock. You know, this is like the grit of it. And so I don't know how it's being received, but I love that you're receiving it well, because I think that's what I'm here to do, right?
I mean, it feels it. I it feels it to me. I mean, you've really moved me again. Like I said, I really appreciate it. Anyways, I'll leave it be. Thanks again, Daniel.
You.
We'll stay in touch. I know that I can go off the radar, but I'm thinking about you often. And I'm, again, grateful that you would do this, that you would deliver this.
Any random thought you have, idea? There's probably something in the library that, right? Because, like, the Akashic records are open now. So if you're like, oh, Huxley's like, oh, what's going on with the moon? I'm like, you know what? You know, blah, blah, blah. And yeah.
You know I love to talk about the moon. Okay, we got to stop there. We got to stop. Okay, thanks again.
Okay, love you, buddy.
Love you, too.
Catch you later.
The Stumble Forward is an Isadora Media production and is hosted by Huxley Workman and produced by Jennifer Cavanaugh. Be sure to subscribe and follow The Stumble Forward. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/Huxley Workman. Thank you for listening.
Stumble Forward, Stumble Forward, The Stumble Forward.